to the Athenaeum Review podcast, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima, and our guest today is Volker M. Welter, professor of architectural history at UC Santa Barbara, and the author of several books, including Biopolis, Patrick Geddes and the City of Life, Ernst L. Freud Architect, The Case of the Modern Bourgeois Home, Walter S. White, Inventions in Mid-Century Architecture, and Tremaine Houses, One Family's Patronage of Domestic Architecture in Mid-Century America, along with many articles, and he's also received grants from the Getty, the Paul Mellon Center, and the Canadian Center for Architecture, among others. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to start by asking you about this interesting figure, Patrick Geddes, who was the subject of some of your earlier work, who had studied biology with Huxley in 19th century Britain and had a wide variety of interests. And I believe he was called the professor of things in general by, I think, Lewis Mumford, who was an important person for kind of conveying his influence. He had, it seems, these very original ideas about town planning and things like this. When I hear something about town planning today, let's say here in Dallas, it's often presented in this extremely or entirely kind of quantitative, technocratic, rational way, that it's a question of you count how many cars move past at a certain hour, and that's how big the road needs to be, or how many people will live here, and that's how much space you need. But it sounds like Geddes had a much broader sense of what a town or city is.
Well, this is very interesting that you actually go back to sort of my very first proper sort of academic project, because that was obviously the studies for my PhD at the University of Edinburgh. And I mean, I came across Geddes somewhat accidentally, because I wanted to originally do the PhD on something with German expressionism in architecture, and maybe something on Bauhaus architecture or Bauhaus modernism. And when I discussed this at Edinburgh University, what I was going to do with my advisor, Professor Ian Boyd White, then I mentioned sort of in passing that there was this Scottish town planner who had designed the core of modern day Tel Aviv. He did a master plan for Tel Aviv in 1925. And that's when Ian Boyd White sort of told me that would be a good topic for your PhD. And I must admit, initially, I had not really an idea what I was getting into with Patrick Geddes. But as it happened, I was very quickly very much fascinated by him, because he is not a town planner in the sense that you just explained, that we're dealing with width of streets and the amount of cars which we can channel through street junctions and basic numerical facts about towns. And I think Geddes, and this was what really caught my attention, that Geddes comes really out of an thinking in the Scottish Enlightenment about what actually makes a good human society.
Right.
A civic society with civic responsibilities. And that's where Geddes basically said, look, we have towns and we have cities. And cities for him were communities of human beings which sort of create a civil society, a civic society. And so he often describes himself as a city designer. He's again not talking about sort of the how many houses, how many apartments, how many or flats, as they call them in Scotland. But he talks about sort of what cultural institutions are necessary. How can we sort of care for the spiritual well-being of citizens, even of citizens of different beliefs? How can we sort of ensure that the city is in harmony with the hinterland, with the region? So that's the kind of approach he had, where his knowledge from biology and then him moving into sociology and eventually into this emerging field of town planning, where he sort of has this very idiosyncratic approach, which basically guaranteed that he was an outsider within the profession for almost his entire professional life.
So the profession was already sort of
I think, in the late 19th century, obviously, the profession of town planning begins to emerge. And we have Geddes proposing in Scotland, sitting initially in Scotland and then later in London, proposing his sort of regional an idea of city design as creating a civic society. We have Ebenezer Howard in the United Kingdom, who was a stenographer in the House of Parliament. Yeah. And he then came up with the idea of garden cities as his response to the sort of endless reports and discussions in the House of Parliament about the working class crisis and the misery of working class areas and cities. So we obviously have, in the beginning, lots of people moving into this area of emerging town planning who did not have a background as a town planner. I mean, we also have architects moving into this field. And I think for Geddes, the difficulty or where it became challenging for him and also for colleagues is that colleagues, especially when they were trained as architects or came out of statistics or out of economics, right, that they, of course, were used to deal with the hard facts. Whereas Geddes sort of comes with this idea that there is biological life and you have to create certain conditions for the life to thrive, environmental conditions. And he, as a biologist, he was interested in very small organisms. And then when he, for various reasons, could no longer do this, for example, he could no longer study on microscopes, he then essentially shifts the scale of his study. So he moves away from single cell or small, very small organisms, which you have to study through a microscope, and he moves onto a scale of his fellow human beings, where we can study each other without necessarily right. having to have sort of a technical device. And that's, I think, where the difficulty for Geddes lied, was that he was working on a scale, working with ideas, and they were an outsider. I think they would have appeared to be all over the place.
Right.
Because he may have talked about economics, then he moved on into ecology, in the early right. ecological thought. Then he might have speculated about inheritance. Is it Lamarck or is the Darwinian? I mean, he right. was a Darwin supporter. So he could move effortlessly from one into the other. But it was always or very often tied to then making planning ideas, a new park to create a new neighborhood. And I think for a proper town planner, somebody who has this sort of technical background, it must have been quite unsettling that this gentleman comes along and sort of has all these ideas. But in the end, I think, and that's when I described him as a sort of an outsider. I mean, right. he knew everybody, he was on the right conference, but I mean, he often lost his planning commissions or he lost out in competitions to other town planners. And when he does actual plans or comes up with city plans, city ideas, he often also simply put them into motion and then sort of said, look, here we can have an architecture school, we can have an art school, we can start certain initiatives, and then the local population, the local university, the people who live locally in the city, they can then pick up these ideas and they can take them and run. So he was kind of initiating things, injecting right. ideas, and then he was happily off to the next place right, right. and left you as the local person or regional people to deal with these ideas.
Got it. You mentioned a moment ago that you've done your doctoral work in Edinburgh and so forth, and I wondered also if someone comes to visit Edinburgh today or one of the other cities you mentioned, Tel Aviv, are there things, if you come as, say, a tourist, are there things that you would notice that reflect the impact of his kind of work still today?
I mean, to start with Edinburgh, I mean, that city, if you go to Edinburgh today and you read in tourist guides about Edinburgh, printed ones or on the web, I mean, sooner or later the name Geddes will pop up.
Right.
Because he did have, I mean, significant impact sort of in the physical fabric of the city. And if you know a little bit about the physical makeup of the city of Edinburgh, there is the old town, which on one end sort of is bracketed or with the castle rock on which the actual castle sits, and then the Royal Mile, the high street, sort of goes down that old town rock, and at the other end is the palace, the Holyrood Palace. And at the top of this, just below the castle, that's where Geddes actually built a huge complex, a big arts and crafts complex of student housing. So he initiated very early student housing projects in Edinburgh, but also apartments for himself and for other professors and artists. And then right next to it, there is a very interesting institution called the Outlook Tower. And that still exists today. Today, it's an entire tourist attraction, which has a camera obscura on top, which it already had when Geddes owned the tower. And I mentioned earlier that at some point in Geddes' career, he had real problems with his eyesight and could no longer study single-cell organisms through microscope. And then he shifted onto the scale of human beings and human societies, sort of looking at human urban societies, rural societies in, if you want, a regional laboratory setting. And so the Outlook Tower was a really interesting device which he developed. It was kind of the equivalent to the microscope for the biologist. And it was a several-story tower, which older Scottish building, and then in the 1850s it had been extended in 50s or 60s, and the camera obscura was put on top as a as a tourist attraction by a lady who was called Short, was a family name. And then at some point in the 1890s, Geddes took over the tower and he kept the camera obscura. And there were two staircases in the tower, a central one and a smaller one. The smaller one is no longer existing. And you were supposed to walk up the smaller staircase with, I believe it was a spiral stair. And then you came up to the top of the tower, heavily sort of trying to catch your breath, which was the deliberate attempt to get you there and to get your body really physically working. And Geddes then always claimed if you get into that kind of state of, I'm struggling for the word, of sort of physical excitement, simply right. because you're panting, you're trying to get breath. He said you're specifically perceptive then for impressions, visual and sense impressions. And so the first, you went onto the top terrace, which was a viewing platform, and you could view over the city of Edinburgh, and then you could look into the region of Edinburgh. Right. So you could look towards the Pentland Hills, and then in the other direction, you would look towards the Firth of Forth, where the water goes into, runs into the land. Then you were supposed to step into the small building which had the actual camera obscura, and then you see essentially the same image. But now, we see the image sort of reflected through the lens, through the mirror, onto the viewing table, and of course, sort of in the reverse, which has to do with the physics, how the view goes through the lens and the camera, the lens and the camera and the mirror onto that viewing table. And then, so you were to studying exactly what you just seen. In reality, you now were studying an image of it. And then you were supposed to go into the first floor below the viewing platform, and that floor was dedicated to the city of Edinburgh. The next floor to the city, to Scotland as the region. Then there was an area which was dedicated to the British Isles and the English language, essentially the British Empire. He never really called it the British Empire. He called it the English language, or some kind of euphemism. And then eventually at the end, at the lowest level, you would come to the level of the world. So it was kind of a reverse microscope, whereas a microscope obviously takes something small and enlarges it so that you can see it. The Outlook Tower took something sort of small and made it ever smaller in relation to these expanding geographical frames of references. And Geddes, for him, this was looking at a city like this through an outlook tower was essentially the beginning of becoming aware of the city. On each floor, he had, let's say, physical models of the topography of Edinburgh or of parts in Scotland. There were historic maps, historic engravings, photographic surveys. And so you could, on each level, you were supposed to engage with the position of Edinburgh within Scotland, Edinburgh within the British Isles, for example, Edinburgh within Europe, Edinburgh within the world. And so from geographical points of view, and there were literature, there were images. And so and at the very end of the Outlook Tower, at the lowest level, on the level of the world, there were this wonderful globe of, there was a globe of the earth, and then there was a second globe which had the sky painted on it. So you got sort of on the cosmological level, and then there was a small thinking cell in this lowest level, which was basically a small room totally darkened with curtains and just the chair in it, and that was it. So you were going to get in there to meditate about all the impressions, and then you were sort of finally released to leave this Outlook Tower. And then when you went out through the main door, which gives access to the main staircase, which is the one you would use today if you were to walk up and down that tower, then you were suddenly on the high street of Edinburgh. So then you're back into the real city. But Geddes claimed you would be almost a transformed, better human being who would then be energized to go out and to become active as a citizen in the community. And that was for him sort of really important. And so this Outlook Tower still exists today in Edinburgh. And if you then start walking down the Royal Mile, so there, and you read up a little bit, you can actually then see traces of his urban interventions. There are lots of buildings where he may have put up a new building, or he added some sculptures to an older building, or there are certain carvings in stone door surrounds, sort of things which remind you of different historical periods of Edinburgh. So you could literally walk down the entire Royal Mile and you could study every single historical period of Edinburgh. So, and then on the other side, of course, if we now go to Tel Aviv, that's where Geddes was invited in 1925 to produce the master plan for Tel Aviv. The connection between Geddes and the Zionist movement in, as it was then called, Palestine or British Palestine, that Especially came about through Weizmann, who was the key figure in the early history of Zionism, but who also was, I think, a chemist, if I remember correctly, at Manchester University. So Geddes knew Weizmann through their natural science background. But Geddes also had connections with others with Jewish intellectuals who later became Zionists. There's Israel Zangwill, very famous Jewish playwright, who was very fascinated by the urban renewal work Geddes had done in the 1890s and the 1900s in Edinburgh. And Zangwill later became a supporter of Zionism. And there was David Eder, or David Eder, E-D-E-R, who was a medical doctor and the first British psychoanalyst in the Freudian tradition. And Geddes knew also Eder, and Eder also became a big figure in early Zionism. So that's the connections, how Geddes got in contact with the Zionists. And when, after the Balfour Declaration, and towards the end of the First World War, which essentially granted the Jewish people the right to return back to Eretz Israel, to the land of the forefathers, then the question was for the Zionists, how can you actually settle this land quickly, take in a huge number? There were obviously ideas that there are large numbers of Jewish people are interested in moving back. And if one reads up the letters in the Central Zionist Archives, the correspondence about this in the archives in Jerusalem, becomes pretty quickly clear that the British Zionists, who by that time had sort of taken over from the German Zionist movement to run the international Zionist movements, because the Germans obviously were no longer sort of, what's the right word? I mean, after the end of the First World War, they were no longer, did not have the political power, they were not politically acceptable at all. It was pretty clear that Geddes came into this because he offered an expertise. As David Eder writes in one letter, he says, Geddes is really good because he looks into the future, but he also is very much aware of the importance of history and the importance of the past. And he can actually deal with sort of both sides of this equation. And that obviously the Zionist project was, of course, recreating a new nation state for the Jewish people, but it was also a nation state which sort of claimed to have deep roots in the history, the biblical history of obviously the Jewish people, and sort of this being their first homeland, and then they were expelled and now they are returning. So it was this kind of intellectual sort of setting which Geddes bridged. And then Tel Aviv existed outside of Jaffa since 1909. And there was a small suburb founded outside of Jaffa, Jaffa was a mixed Jewish, Arab, and sort of Christian town, one of the oldest cities in the world. And out of this suburb, which was called Tel Aviv, then the city of Tel Aviv grew. It had grown sort of with small neighborhoods being created here and there next to the original Tel Aviv suburb or neighborhood. And then in 1925, the idea came, Geddes was essentially on his way to India, where he had a professorship for sociology. And so he was going forth and back between the United Kingdom and India. And then the Zionists asked him to produce a town plan for Tel Aviv. Geddes produced, I think, one of the most interesting town plans which come out of the modern town planning movement. I mean, this is 1925, so we have already in Germany, obviously, the Bauhaus. We have Le Corbusier sort of creating very interesting architecture at that time in France. We have in the Netherlands, we have the modernism, this style, and out. So this is all becoming visible in Europe, that there is a real new architectural movement. And at some point in an article I wrote about the town plan of Tel Aviv, I'm sort of saying, you know, Le Corbusier had a really hard time to realize his urban visionary cities in the 1920s. It comes much later that he could actually build a city, Chandigarh, or contribute significantly to a completely new city. Geddes sort of actually his city was built, the city of Tel Aviv. And he was a very interesting town plan. He basically takes the territory which runs parallel to the Mediterranean coastline and is essentially north of Jaffa and extends to the north of Tel Aviv. And there is a river, the Yarkon River, which sort of comes from the east and goes into the Mediterranean. So that's the core territory which Geddes plans. And he sets up a network of streets which essentially run from north-south, but the main arteries of this plan, they all pick up streets coming out of historic Jaffa. And so he literally sort of says, you don't ever have to plan a new street. You just have to look at an existing street and sort of extend that street. And then you will most likely pick sort of the paths people tend to travel. And then he has east-west streets, and so he creates kind of rectangular super blocks, which are essentially oriented more or less north-south parallel to the Mediterranean coastline. And then each of the super blocks then has sort of four streets surrounding a super block, then have access streets which lead you into the center of the super block, where Geddes planned a small public space, let's say like a rectangle cut out from the rectangle, which is the super block. And then you have at the edges of the super blocks, you have two rows of housing. So you have one row of housing, single family housing, which is accessible from the north, south or the east, west streets. And then the internally, you have a second row of housing, and they have to essentially go through short passageways into the inner part of the block. Uh-huh. And then they access their houses from the public space. So he sets up this city, which has really interesting like a network of walking paths. You can walk the entire city of Tel Aviv. You only occasionally have to cross a major street, which obviously today has car traffic. His idea was that this would be a city which has two-story houses, and there would be lots of gardens, and the people could engage in flower gardening and also in vegetable and fruit gardening. The what makes Tel Aviv so fascinating, of course, is that when Geddes did his plan in 25 and eventually it began to be implemented, and then we come into the early 1930s, and of course then we have the German people voting Hitler into power, and the anti-Semitism, which then begins sort of with Jews being kicked out of Germany, being kicked out of Europe, and that obviously exaggerates or accelerates with the beginning of the Second World War and then the Endlösung or the Holocaust. So there is this massive influx of refugees into the territory, and there is a very rapid build-up of the city of Tel Aviv, as there were other areas in then Palestine where lots and lots of people had to be accommodated. Yeah. With those refugees, of course, Bauhaus architects come to Palestine, or students, Jewish students who were at the Bauhaus, I mean, come back into their home country. And so we have this Geddes town plan, and the architecture in Tel Aviv, in the core of Tel Aviv, is what the Tel Avivis call Bauhaus architecture.
Right, right.
So which is essentially white cubes with flat roofs. For Tel Aviv, more of the architecture, I think, is probably inspired by Le Corbusier. Because there were, of course, also Jewish students who were studying in France or in the Netherlands. But in Tel Aviv, it all goes under the brand name of Bauhaus architecture.
Right, right.
So the influence of Geddes in Tel Aviv, I think, is far more subtle. One has to really know about his town plan. For example, suggested in a certain part in the town, there should be a concentration of cultural institutions. Like a theater and a music hall. And if you know the city of Tel Aviv and you know, for example, where the Habima Theater is and the big concert hall, then we are exactly in the territory where Geddes imagined that's where the cultural institution should be concentrated. So the influence is definitely there, but it is probably less visible as it is, for example, in Edinburgh.
Right.
And you basically have to know about this earlier history of Tel Aviv.
Okay.
But if you... And this was what fascinated me the first time I actually was in Tel Aviv. I was absolutely captivated by these Bauhaus architecture. I mean, I was an architecture student in Berlin, but I was also puzzled by the plan of the city, because it was not one of these modernist plans as one knows them, for example, from Siemensstadt or some of the Thomas Hütter, these great social housing estates of 1920s modernism. Whereas, and this was really puzzling for me always, this contradiction.
Right.
And that's obviously then I started working on Geddes. Then at some point, it became clear where this tension actually comes from.
Amazing. Yeah, because so. I do think that the Bauhaus Tel Aviv is very famous, but it seems like probably the history with Geddes is much less obvious, as you say. I also wanted to ask, it seems like Geddes has the sense that science and religion can be harmoniously related, or a so-called merger of science and religion, and that for for setting up a city, the importance not only, again, of the kind of practical things, but also having something like a temple, like the Acropolis. And I was thinking, you know, in these very ancient cities, certainly in Europe or other ancient civilizations, you have these ancient cities which are centered around some sort of sacred place like that, you know, just thinking about Notre Dame in Paris and so forth. Mm-hmm. But I was curious, also hearing you talk about Tel Aviv, when it comes to a modern city or a new city, or certainly like most of our cities here in the United States, where that don't have that ancient history or pre-modern past, how exactly does that sense of spirituality or religion, if at all, connect with it?
I mean, this was absolutely essential. You cannot have a city which only consists of, let's say, urban neighborhoods, a shopping district,
right,
maybe some industrial business park, office park, where you produce things. That, in Geddes's understanding, is not a city. That he calls a town.
Right.
And it only becomes a city when you have these certain nodes, for which I use in my work on Geddes, I use the expression cultural acropolis. And this term has to do with that the Acropolis in Athens, of course, sits physically above the city. So it sits on this rock, and that's where all the temples are. So it's physically, it's visible within the city. And that's what Geddes was always after. If you have these concentrations of certain cultural institutions, universities, art museums, study centers, laboratories, then you have to concentrate them physically in one area, and you have to make them visible in the cities. And the easiest, of course, is to put them on the highest point in the city.
Right.
So in Edinburgh, this was very conveniently the entire old town, which also physically is the highest point in the already sort of a pretty lively topography of Edinburgh. And that's where the university was located in on that high part of the town. And that's where Geddes builds this apartment complex for professors, intellectuals, artists, and students.
Right.
So to inject these kind of intellectual classes into the urban realm and to marry town and gown.
Right.
In Tel Aviv, also these cultural institutions, they are sort of concentrated actually on the highest point within Tel Aviv, which is one has to understand this very relative, because one doesn't really notice one is on the highest point, but it is actually sort of really on the physical highest territory. And so forget it, but you not only had to have these cultural institutions, but you also had sort of this temple-like building. And so, and he was not talking here about a church in a traditional sense, sort of like Scottish Presbyterianism, sort of that you have a kirk, like a high kirk.
Right.
I mean, they were historically, obviously, in cities, and they were always important for Geddes, that these, historically speaking, these churches, cathedrals, they should never be torn down. They should be sort of reused, rebuilt, repaired, because they do express, historically speaking, where the spiritual forces become visible in the urban fabric. Now, at his own time, of course, I mean, Geddes does come out of a Scottish sort of religious tradition. He was very, very firm in his Bible readings. I mean, he could quote the Bible, and he knew the Bible in and out. And so when you read his letters with the early Zionists, he always quotes from the Bible and sort of says, I consider myself like this or that person in the Bible.
Right.
He was very convinced that he had this sort of almost biblical task to sort of rebuild Eretz Israel and Jerusalem. But then he designs, essentially, he comes up with modern day temple complexes. So if we stay with, for example, with his work in Palestine for the Zionists, Geddes also got the commission to design the Hebrew University, which was this attempt of European and American Zionists to establish an institution of higher learning in early Palestine, and which was supposed to be located in Jerusalem on Mount Scopus, and it actually exists on Mount Scopus. Today it also has a second campus, which obviously has to do with that Jerusalem was for a long time not accessible from the state of Israel. And so for the Mount Scopus site, Geddes then designs a very interesting, very complex university master plan, but at the center of this master plan was a graduation hall where you would have your graduation ceremonies at the end of the academic year. And this hall, I mean, his son-in-law, Sir Frank Mears, a Scottish architect, designed, and this building is full of symbolism. It's kind of built on a floor plan, which sort of is developed from the Star of David, and it's covered on the inside with Stars of David, but also with other symbols. and sort of recalling sciences. And so he sort of tried to really, and it's very carefully, the size of the dome is very carefully developed in relation to the Dome of the Rock. It of course had to be larger. It's also larger than St. Peter's in Rome, and to make that clear, and it's also larger than Hagia Sophia in Constantinople or in Istanbul, to make it absolutely clear that, so to speak, the world religions, they have their place, but now we are sort of creating our domed building. Very interesting. I mean, this is so full of symbolism. I mean, of course, none of this ever got built. And to the best of my knowledge, Geddes never had a chance to actually build one of these modern city temples. Okay. He always proposes them. If you look at his town planning work he does in British India, in many cities today in India or in Pakistan, he always designs somewhere this cultural complex. Sometimes it's an urban square, which maybe has the shape of a hexagon or an octagon, and that becomes the symbolic center. Sometimes it is a university. And even in 1923, if I remember correctly, I think it was 23, Geddes was in the United States. And Sir Frank Mears, for example, designs an outlook tower for an American city. So he actually translates this idea into a skyscraper with an outlook tower on top of the skyscraper. So where then the outlook tower, and there was a museum in this complex, where that then was supposed to become this kind of symbolic new spiritual temple center. So the spirituality, I don't think was religious in any traditional sense. But it was really this kind of vitalist, Henry Bergson-inspired life philosophy, Lebensphilosophie, cast into stone. Mm-hmm. So this mixture of that, we have to basically re-spiritualize the hardcore sciences. I mean, Geddes at some point studied or went into study biology, and there is this anecdote that he basically got out of his studies because he was asked to dissect or to work with a dissected body of some laboratory animal. For him, I mean, this was absolutely, you cannot study life by looking at a dead animal's body.
Right.
So, and this is where he sort of positioned himself. You have to study the animal, obviously, or the organism in its environmental setting. And that's where he had a famous formula, which was function, organism, environment. So how these things are related to each other. And that's where this notion of the temple comes from. Okay. There's a really interesting, I mean, this, when you look at the Geddesian temple schemes, I mean, they're fantastic architectural drawings, and they are sort of full of this symbolism. And at the same time, one also has sort of a strong sense that, of course, they are only symbols and they only work as a quasi-religious sites for those who are already initiated into the cult, if you want. Yeah. Otherwise, you don't understand. I mean, it's just like entering a temple or a sacred building of a distinct religion. If you don't know something about this religion, you may admire the craftsmanship of certain mosaic works, but the symbolic meaning will never really become clear to you. You may have an inkling that this is an important space, but one doesn't really understand this. And so in many of these Geddesian temple schemes, I mean, they were like really fanciful drawings or utopian visions. But the scheme in itself does have really interesting influence on modern 20th century town planning when we come to the period of the mid-20s. At the end of the Second World War and the collapse, obviously, of the big dictatorships, or some of the big dictatorships in Europe. Stalinism, of course, was not collapsing, but the National Socialist or the fascist dictatorships. And I mean, that did also raise for many people the question sort of what is the value of modernity, of modernism, of modern life, because they were all implicated in these dictatorships. Yeah. And so we have this turn towards a new humanism at the end of the Second World War in the early 1950s. And the CIAM, the Congress International d'Architecture Moderne, this pressure group, which was founded in the late 1920s and had regular conferences, like the 1933 conference from which the Charter of Athens was emerged, this big town planning document, which sort of said that cities should have sort of the residential zones, the working zones, the recreational zones, and then these communication lines, which connect these three zones and allow the citizens to move around. And there was an equivalent CMA conference, which was called under the theme of the Heart of the City. And the Heart of the City, that was sort of an attempt by many architects. If you look at the proceedings of the Siam conference, it's all about public spaces in cities and how can you create meaningful public spaces, how can you furnish these public spaces with cultural institutions, with museums, with educational institutions. And you suddenly realize this really is an echo of the Gedesian idea of having a cultural acropolis in the city. And there's a biographical lab. There is a Jacqueline Turwitt, who was a British town planner, and she was a student of Geddes. She never met with Geddes, but she was a follower, a very serious student of Geddes. And she was also the secretary to Siam. She was the translator of books into English by Siegfried Gideon. She was a real key figure in transmitting this Gedesian thinking into the mid-century debate about among modernist architects and town planners. And so I think in the end, one could sort of say he was actually, even though he was always on the outside of modern town planning, sort of in the immediate post-war period, I think he was actually right at the heart of it. A very, very interesting sort of trajectory, how his ideas come back. Yeah. I mean, it also ties, of course, into the city crown idea, which Bruno Taut had in Germany. So Geddes was not sort of entirely unique in this thinking, that was the crucial part for his approach to town planning. And that, of course, again, I think sets him against certain other people who sort of think, what is this gentleman talking about? I mean, even though Le Corbusier, I mean, if you read very carefully his writings, you always find that even somebody like Le Corbusier was looking for a certain spiritual dimension for his work, for his life. But I think Geddes was just sort of convinced that that's actually the key. And if you look at his Indian town planning works, he often suggests all you have to do is like an incubator almost. You have to put these cultural institutions into a city.
Yeah.
And then from there, or into a town, and from there, eventually the city will emerge.
Amazing. Well, it's been very interesting to read some of your published writing on different figures and see some of the connections among them. For instance, kind of the question, how questions of psychology and the environment relate to building. And so I wanted to next ask you about your research on Ernst Freud, the architect who was the son of Sigmund Freud and the father of Lucian Freud. And I think in the title of your book, the case of the subtitle, The Case of the Modern Bourgeois Home, there's this implication of a kind of paradox or tension in that the relationship between modernism and the bourgeois has some tensions in it. And I guess Freud as an architect was, I guess, in some way embodied that tension or explored it. So could you tell us about kind of what is the relation between modernism and the bourgeois for Ernst Freud?
Yeah, I mean, Ernst Freud, that was a real labor of love project. There's no other way to describe this, because it actually goes back to the 1990s when I was still living in then West Berlin in the late 1980s, early 1990s. And I was working as a historian, I was a student of architecture at that time, for a private architectural office in West Berlin, which was working in restoration and assessing the structural integrity of buildings which were supposed to be listed as monuments. So the equivalent in America would be a building which goes into the National Register of Historical Monuments. And one of the buildings we were looking at was a country house outside of Berlin, the Frank Country House, which was a huge private villa country house at Lake Schwilo, fantastic, overlooking the lakeside. And we did an initial assessment of this building, and my task in these assessments always was sort of to figure out what was the historical importance of the buildings, who was the architect, where are historical sources like images and so on. And this building was interesting because for a long time, nobody knew who was the architect, especially during the building was at the end of the Second World War until the early 90s. It was within East Germany, and then it became accessible, obviously, with the collapse of East Germany and with the wall finally being taken down. And eventually, one journalist, Lili von Thurn und Taxis, she then figured out in the early 1990s, she was writing for West Berlin Daily newspaper, she figured out that the architect was Ernst Freud, a son of Sigmund Freud. And ever since I was involved with this project, I kept literally a box where I was collecting information about Ernst Freud. So whenever something came up, I just copied it and it went into this box. Eventually, and I was always fascinated by this. I always thought this is really interesting that Freud had an architect son. Because it was interested, and I was interested in this because I had never heard about this architect. Because when you grow up in Germany and you go into studying architecture and then you study in, or you studied in West Berlin, I mean, you learn so much about Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, Walter Gropius, and the Bauhaus. And all these names were, I mean, they were always around us. The buildings were in Berlin around us. We could go to look at the social housing complexes. But this Freud, this was never there. And I was always really interested in architectural history, and that always captivated me. So for a long time, I just collected Freud, and then once I finished my doctorate, and then I decided I finally want to do something with this Freud material. The big question was what actually to do with this Freud material, because whenever I spoke to people about Freud, then of course, oh yeah, this is Sigmund Freud, this is psychoanalysis. And this is, you have to sort of look at it from that point of view. But I'm not a psychoanalyst. And to be quite honest, I'm also not entirely convinced that I'm actually really deeply interested in psychoanalysis. Right. All sorts of reasons. But I also always thought that it is not right. It always felt not right to me. And initially, I don't think there was a different vocabulary available to me. I always thought it's not right to sort of analyze or to look at the son simply in the light of what the father has done.
Right.
I always sort of thought, with all respect to my own father, I always sort of thought, this is not right. One doesn't do something like this. And eventually, and this is where the subtitle comes from, the case study of the modern bourgeois home. Eventually, I mean, I had a long list of projects Freud had worked on. So I had moved to the United Kingdom. I obviously also then could look at the archive of Ernst Freud, which is preserved with the Royal Institute of British Architects in London, because Freud lived from late 1933 onwards. He left Berlin, he fled Berlin and moved with his three sons and his wife to London, and so his private office papers, they ended up at the RIBA, and so I had a chance to look at the RIBA archival collection, and at that point I realized that Freud never ever participated in everything which stands in architectural history, or apparently stands in architectural history, for Weimar Republic Germany. Social housing estates, no Freud contribution. Schools, hospitals, all these socially initiated projects, Freud is never there. Instead, he designs country houses, large private villas. He designs extremely comprehensive interiors for these lavish bourgeois apartments in Berlin. Sometimes, you know, these apartments, they had maybe 20 rooms or something. They were sort of on an entire floor of an apartment building, and you can get these Freud designs, 40, 50, 60 pieces of furniture. I mean, he designs the tables, the couches, the bookshelves, and the liquor trolleys where you can sort of wheel a trolley with liquor bottles in it on caster wheels, and everything is designed. So he's really, and this took me a while to realize, that he's actually really working for the bourgeoisie, for the upper middle classes, the middle classes, primarily the Jewish middle classes in Berlin, upper middle classes, but not entirely. There were also clients which were clearly not of Jewish background. And that's where then this project became really interesting for me, because I thought, this gives me actually access to look at Freud and sort of answering the question, why is he not appearing in the history of German modern architecture? Yeah. And to cut through this in a nutshell, the argument I'm putting forward is that Freud is essentially written out of the history because his work doesn't fit into the standard historiography of this period. Because in retrospect, we are obviously looking at Weimar Republic Germany in hindsight, with the knowledge that onto the Weimar Republic was followed by National Socialism and the Holocaust in the larger German history. And so we are looking always sort of at the Weimar Republic, sort of how could this happen? How could all this sort of these wonderful initiatives for social housings and modernizing German society, democracy in Germany, how could all this sort of in a funnel sort of end up in National Socialism? Yeah. And so the history of the Weimar Republic, in a sort of expressed in simple terms, is basically considered, I mean, either you were with the socialists or the communists, Luxembourg, Liebknecht, and those forces, with the people who were sort of critically about this, on the political left, or you were sort of working with the reactionary forces, with the traditionalists. And you know that this wonderful argument, which they at some point had in 1920s in German architecture, sort of the pitched roof of das Flachdach gegen das Steildach. And it was literally interpreted that the pitched roof is an expression of a reactionary mindset.
Right.
Whereas the flat roof, simply because it's flat and unusual, it is apparently a sign of your progressive attitude.
Right.
And what I realized then, reading a lot about Weimar Republic architecture and also reading source books from that time, publications from the period, always hoping I can find something about Freud, I realized that there is a whole disk Mittelklassen Wohnungen and how do the upper bourgeoisie, how are they, the upper middle classes, how can they live? And this was an absolute eye-opener for me, because when I was a student in Berlin, I had never heard about this. Pages over pages, books over books, how to actually create floor plans for these large houses, for the industrialists who built themselves country houses. And so that's where the project then took shape, and sort of saying, okay, obviously I want to discuss where Freud came from and what figure he was, but not a biography, but sort of saying, look, here we have this architect who was entirely living this middle class, upper middle class life. He was working for these people, creating their worlds, and that obviously came all to an end, a very sudden end, because he and many of his clients, they had to flee for their lives after 1933. There is, so to speak, and I was what I called on a conference I went to a few months ago at the Quarto Institute in London. I said, there is a second exile of Freud. And the second exile is that after 45, he was never basically being written back into the history, because this whole bourgeois discussion about bourgeois housing and so on, that simply was non-existent. And this is very interesting. When you begin looking like this, you suddenly realize that the architectural history of the Weimar Republic is not a simple juxtaposition of left versus right, flat roof versus pitched roof, progressives, communists, socialists versus national socialists, and so on the other side. And that obviously exists, this juxtaposition, but there is sort of this third pole. And this sort of, it's actually more like a triangular relationship. There is the philosopher Helmut Plesner, who wrote this interesting book in 1924, Critique of Social Radicalism, The Limits of Community, Critique of Social Radicalism, where he basically puts forward an argument saying that Germany, in Weimar Republic Germany, doesn't need more socialism, doesn't need more community ideas of the blood, as he calls the community's ideas on the right. Political right, but he says what we need is this bourgeois society, and that's where Freud obviously comes in. And for architectural history, when you begin looking at projects and designs, it becomes really interesting. Take, for example, the Tugendhat Villa by Mies van der Rohe, this wonderful, wonderful house in Brünn in the Czech Republic, and this building with one of the earliest lavish open floor plans on the living room level, and these big glass sheets which can be lowered down and you can open it up into the house, into the surroundings. And when we talk about that building, it used to be so that one suddenly begins talking about sort of abstract concepts of space. And when we talk about the social housing estates at the same time, we're talking about minimum existence. How many square footage can we have? But what for a long time was never really discussed is, what is the social background of the Tugendhat House? And I mean, they were very wealthy entrepreneurs, industrial business people, and they built themselves this wonderful lavish house. And I always thought sort of, I mean, one thinks, well, we should discuss this. I mean, nowadays it is discussed because things have changed. But one should discuss these large country houses, not only as in suddenly we're shifting the category, we're no longer talking existence minimum, we are suddenly talking abstract categories of space. Let's talk about that. This is a house for a wealthy family.
Yeah.
And then when you start looking at the photographs, the floor plans, the images, then you suddenly realize actually that all the bourgeois elements are in the house. So if you look at early black and white photographs, when you entered the Tugendhat House, there was a small foyer space before then the stair goes down into the lower level, because the house is built on a slope. So you enter on the upper level and you walk down into this fantastic living, open plan living room area, for which the house is really famous for. But on the upper level, once you are through that actual door inside the house, you're looking at a beautiful paneled wall of I think it's Makassar ebony, very, very beautiful wood paneling, very expensive, very sort of an immediate expression of the wealth. But then in front of this panel, you have sort of two chairs, tubular steel chairs and a small table. And on the table, you often see in photographs, there's like a little bowl, which maybe it was like an ashtray, but I think it was actually a bowl, for example, where you put down your visitor's card. So you can find these rituals, the social rituals of how certain classes sort of initiated. You go to, you drop off your visitor's card, the maid takes the card to the lady of the house, and then the lady reads your name, and then either you are admitted or you, the maid comes back, and that either the lady of the house isn't in, or that she is sort of under migraine or whatever. So there are these rituals in which social contacts are initiated, and you can suddenly see that all this exists in these modernist houses. And so this book about Freud, I mean, that really then turned into, on the one hand, a study of his domestic architectural works, simply, I mean, as a documentary, what did he do, whom did he design for? And also it then turned into this larger project, actually sort of recovering, saying, look, there is a part in the Weimar Republic, Germany, that they may not have succeeded, they may not have sort of be successful with establishing a middle class or an upper middle class society. I think historians could say much more about this. Yeah. But if we want to have a real sort of a comprehensive history of this period, then I think we cannot simply, in hindsight, sort of only looking at two forces where we know the one force we don't want to be associated with.
Right.
And therefore we sort of position ourselves in hindsight on the supposedly right side of history.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this is sort of is really a bizarre concept of writing history. And I think then one has to say, okay, we have the traditionalists, we have the reactionaries, we have the socialists with all their social programs manifesting in architecture. And we also have the middle classes, the bourgeoisie sort of making their point. And in the 90s and 1930s, before 33, there is lots of literature you can find where contemporary writers about architecture, they precisely knew this. Yeah. I mean, there is one gentleman, I think his name is Sigrist Albert, he wrote a book about this Neue Bauen in the early 90s. And somewhere in this book, he actually sort of says that the Neues Bauen, this modernist architecture, has two faces. It is socialist and it's high capitalist. So at that point, there was an absolute awareness that the architecture in itself does not convey a political message, but that the architecture is used by sort of different players within the field of politics. And that awareness, I think, has basically disappeared, or for a long time was not available. And essentially, architecture was simply read as, if it's cubic, white, and social housing, it is the good kind of architecture. And if it's the other architecture, then it is sort of, it's always measured against this ideal of the Bauhaus. Sort of how far is it close or away from the Bauhaus? And that's where I think Freud became really interesting. I mean, the last other point, very interesting of Freud, of course, is that during this work, I then also discovered that Ernst Freud actually designed for all the psychoanalysts, the first generation of psychoanalysts who had trained in Vienna with his father, and but then lived in Berlin and worked in Berlin, that Ernst Freud had actually designed for almost all of them the psychoanalytical consulting rooms, including the couches. So there is this one chapter in the book which doesn't immediately deal with domestic or architecture in itself, but with this very interesting sort of early history of psychoanalytical consulting rooms. And how Ernst Freud actually sort of challenges the way his father positioned the couch in the room. And Ernst Freud also cleared out all these statues and anything. So they become actually modern interiors, anything which kind of collects dust, which one could claim is an ornament, like the Oriental rug, which Sigmund Freud had on his couch. All that doesn't really exist in Ernst Freud's consulting rooms. So that was a real... very interesting, tiny little segue, which the Freud project took on.
I think these questions are so interesting. I'm thinking, well, about, as you discussed, the role of bourgeois patrons and so forth. And that also obviously relates to the story of modern architecture in this country, and the role of kind of bourgeois houses in terms of modern architecture in the United States. But I mentioned that to segue into talking about a more recent project, or actually current project that's coming out very soon, about the Tremaines, two couples who are important patrons of modern architecture and modern art in the United States, and in particular commissioned homes from major modern architects. I guess let me ask, the kind of history you described, the two-sided history in Germany with the flat roofs and the pitched roofs, when it comes to modernism in America and modern homes, I mean, is the history written in a similar way, or is it sort of, you know, good and bad, or progressive and reactionary, or is, do people look at modernism here somewhat differently?
That's a very, very interesting question. I don't think it's as easily answered, which I at least can't as easily answer as sort of maybe a comparable question with regard to Weimar Germany. But I mean, ever since I moved to California, which is in 2003, when I started working at UC Santa Barbara, at that time leaving the United Kingdom, I still am somewhat struck sort of with the great emphasis with architectural history in California, at least, puts on vernacular buildings. And so there is, on the one hand, we have obviously architectural designs done by architects in Californian architectural history. But then on the other hand, there is obviously, and in general in the United States, there is this vernacular architecture or self-building, which I think partially can be understood out of the history of modern day United States, which was a colonizer, or it's a colonial foundation. And obviously the people who colonized the continent, they moved in and they built their own houses. And I mean, this great tradition of self-building and sort of, or disseminating knowledge about how you built your houses through pamphlets, through books, and write down that at some point you could buy your floor plans from sort of a department stores or mail order businesses, and then you just had your plans and you hand them over to the carpenter or whoever can build, and then the house gets built. So that, I think, is so maybe part of this explanation. But then on the other hand, we have obviously sort of architecture, I mean, like the case study houses in California, right. This great program which was initiated in the mid-1940s to sort of channel the production facilities which the defense and the military complex had, the Second World War had sort of, in response to the Second World War, were initiated in Southern California to sort of use these production facilities to modernize the way architecture is produced. Right. And so I think to an outsider, I mean, I live here now for 16 years, I'm not quite that outsider any longer in California, but it is interesting, this complete fascination with sort of established architects and high architecture, case study houses and glass walls and everything. Right. So, and then on the other hand, this fascination with this suburbanization, with this builders suddenly putting up overnight entire neighborhoods almost overnight, and also with this traditions of self-building. And so, but I don't necessarily think one can juxtapose this in sort of a way as the 1920s did this in Germany, where architects in the 20s said, if you do a pitch roof, then you are this, and if you do a flat roof, you are that. But it is interesting, because when I started looking at these Tremaine houses, and I mean, the project literally initiated because of these two really well-known Tremaine houses. There is one Tremaine house with Richard Neutra designed, and that's in Montecito, on the outskirts of Santa Barbara coast in California. And that's a very, very famous building, which, I mean, until very recently has shown up in many, many architectural histories, and it's always talked about. Then there is another Tremaine beach house, which Oscar Niemeyer designed, the Brazilian architect. And that's it has never been built, but it is a very famous building because it's a very beautiful, very poetic design for a small private house immediately at the ocean front, somewhere broadly speaking in the Santa Barbara area. And so this project started sort of with a curiosity that I basically asked, are they actually for the same client? And I thought it's just sort of something I spent one afternoon on or whatever, and then I'll have the answer. And then it became clear very quickly that, first of all, they're not the same clients, even if very often they're confused with each other. So there were two brothers, Warren and Burton Tremaine, from a family. There was another brother, but he wasn't so much a third brother so much into modern architecture. And both of Warren and Burton, they marry independently wealthy wives. The two brothers also come from a very wealthy family because their father was one of the big managers of General Electric. So they already, the brothers were very wealthy and both marry independently wealthy wives. And so these two couples, then the one couple commissioned the house by Richard Neutra, the Neutra Tremaine house, and the other couple commissioned a house by Oscar Niemeyer, which then for a number of reasons wasn't built. So suddenly we were talking about two projects with two clients, very closely related with each other, but different clients. And then it became clear that these were not the only houses which they had designed. So I suddenly got more information and found out more material that the one couple was working, the Niemeyer, clients of Niemeyer, that they also worked a lot with Philip Johnson, whereas the other couple worked with other architects, amongst them Cliff May, the ranch house architect, that also with a local Santa Barbara architect, Luther Maria Riggs. And so the project kind of began to mushroom, and I ended up with, depending on how you count, somewhere between 30 and 40, 35 sort of commissions, architectural commissions. Some of them built, some of them not built, some of them only sketched, some of them very meticulously worked out, most of them domestic architecture. But there are some very interesting sort of projects which were done for the family, not just for one or the other couple, but for the larger family, the larger Tremaine family. There's like a very interesting Philip Johnson Museum at the Meteor Crater in Northern Arizona, which the Tremaines commissioned. And that's a project where it wasn't one of the two couples, but the family had business interests there. Cattle ranching in the area immediately around the Meteor Crater. And so I suddenly had all these various projects, and that's where this idea generated to essentially look at the question of patronage. Why did these couples actually get so into commissioning these houses from these various architects? And there was a happy coincidence that I also was able to locate a tremendous amount of archival materials in terms of drawings, correspondence between the couples, between and their various architects. And this kind of allowed me to flip what I described occasionally as flipping the script. Because usually we'll often discuss sort of, we have an architect, let's say Le Corbusier or Walter Gropius, and we're looking at an architectural oeuvre which was generated by that architect. So we are starting in 1920 and we're finishing 1960 and we have all these projects. And then obviously, I mean, the architect may have worked with different offices or in different offices, different configurations. But essentially we're looking at Le Corbusier's oeuvre of architectural works, or Richard Neutra's architectural works. And here I thought I actually have an opportunity to sort of say, let's look at an oeuvre, an architectural oeuvre that was created not by an architectural firm, but which was created by these clients. And there are two couples. I called it a family because they were working in tandem with each other. And the sort of one couple started with one design in Santa Barbara, and then that became the model for the other couple to do a house. So they were kind of in a sort of in communication about their architecture with each other. And so I thought this can become a really interesting study sort of on what actually is the role of the client in all of this. And how much does the client sort of tell the architect, you do this, you don't do that. And that sort of is the genesis or the origin of this particular project, that I was looking at these couples. And I mean, the study is essentially follows a chronology, and we're starting with the earliest, we're ending with the youngest house. But that there is a certain selective moment in this, that I mean, the Neutra house is obviously in there, the Niemeyer house is in there. And then there are other buildings which I decided are really important to discuss at greater length, because we need to know about them in order to understand the genesis of a later design. So to take the famous Neutra house, for example, it was very interesting to see that the Neutra house, Neutra was the second architect for this house. So the couple was initially negotiating with Luther Maria Riggs, an architect in Santa Barbara, and Riggs. And they started this negotiation in 1944, and Riggs was still very much engaged with doing film set designs in Hollywood, which he had to do in order to survive economically during the years of the Second World War, and never could get her head around designing this country house. For the Tremaines in Santa Barbara. And so that's when Neutra at some point moved in. If you actually, but by that time, Riggs had already designed a big country house in the late 1930s for the other couple, or to be absolutely precise, for the other Mrs. Tremaine, who had two earlier husbands. And this country house, which Riggs had designed for the later Mrs. Tremaine, is essentially the model for the Neutra house. So there were suddenly these very interesting sort of cross-fertilizations becoming to emerge. And one could actually see sort of how certain design ideas sort of gets transmitted from one building into the other building, even across completely different architectural languages. And so the study is, I would describe this sort of, as in a way, it's a very traditional form of architectural history, which really sort of looks at genesis of designs, which looks at the contributions the clients are making. I'm going through lots of letters showing really where the clients sort of begin to develop their own aesthetic understanding of architecture, to the point that Catherine Tremaine and Warren Tremaine, who built the Neutra house, at some point literally begin to argue with Neutra in their letters about aesthetic decisions, and basically telling Neutra, you are wrong on this point. And this is really interesting, a real process of them actually learning a lot about architecture, and so that they can actually defeat almost the architect on his own territory. And it's also a study to some degree about sort of these large country house types, which many architectural historians in the US seem to argue that this type of house really has come to an end in the late 1940s, that there is really no big continuation. And I think that's actually, I find this always really puzzling, this argument, because I think one can actually look at these big modernist houses as a continuation of country house architecture. And so there's some argument in this about that, but essentially it's about these two couples and their architectural productions. Right going through to the latest house was designed in the 1970s. So you also get sort of really in a nutshell sort of the architectural history of a particular type of houses. I mean, on the larger scale, one interesting argument is, I mean, both couples had art collections. Burton and Emily Tremaine, their art collection was really, really famous. They owned the Victory Boogie Woogie by Pete Mondrian, they owned the Three American Flags by Jasper Jones, and lots of their artwork is now in the National Gallery, but there was also, it was auctioned off in the these very, very famous art collection. So there is, to some degree, also the question, I mean, was this architecture only created for the art, or what is the relation of emphasis on architecture in relation to their art collections? At least the way I looked at this and I concluded is that actually in the cases of both couples, there was first the interest in architecture and then the interest in modern art. So it seems to me that was actually really interesting, even though in the case of Emily Tremaine, it was almost literally a matter of months. But before she begins, sort of, she was already engaged in design and having to building a modern house before she then began actually collecting modern art. So that effort was very interesting to see that the art collection sort of interest in art really comes out of the interest in modern architecture, even though eventually I think the interest in modern art overtook the interest in modern architecture. But so that was real, I must admit, sort of from the very, I thought this was a book which I really, really enjoyed writing. I enjoyed literally, I thought it was real fun, sort of, and I think that seems to me at least is important, that putting these information together, sorting out these sort of trajectories of these different houses, looking at the questions, why do they so often start working with female architects and then they drop them unceremoniously? So there is several times where when Luta Maria Riggs or Alberta Pfeiffer, she was a female architect in Connecticut, where one of the couples lived for a long time, they seem to be the standard architects with which the two couples always went to these two women architects whenever they needed something. But as soon as the couples realized that this project could become somewhat more important in a social sense, so that you could raise their standing, very unceremoniously, the female architects got booted off the project. For example, Philip Johnson took over. So there are many, many ways in which I think sort of this case study, I think it's actually really interesting, because it sheds a real light sort of on architectural culture. What is the role of architecture for these private clients. At least for Burton and Emily Tremaine, I think they really tried at some point to really influence the discussion on post-war architecture in the United States. And they clearly were not interested in architecture as a social project.
Right.
I mean, this was absolutely not on their horizon. I didn't find any evidence that they were against something like this, but it just wasn't their interest.
Yeah,
and their interest was really, I think, sort of to regenerate architecture in its interaction with modern art and to sort of create a modern architecture, which is actually the equivalent, artistically speaking, to modern art. So, and I think to some degree, one could probably conclude that that project clearly didn't succeed. I mean, we are discussing architecture mostly nowadays as a social project, as a social commitment, and even as an environmental issue of sustainability. So I think from that point of view, one could potentially sort of say, so what?
Right.
The Tremaine houses. But then again, on the other hand, I mean, speaking here as a historian and not necessarily as somebody who considers that sort of his scholarly or my scholarly work sort of necessarily has to contribute or has to take certain positions in debates about architecture today, I think for a full picture of sort of architecture in California or in the American West, I think it is important to sort of also have the studies of these clients, which were very wealthy. Some would probably call them the super rich or the 1% or whatever.
Right.
And simply saying, okay, but this is architectural reality in the same way as we have at the same time the case study houses or other projects. And lastly, I mean, I also think that I look at this Tremaine House book very much in relation with the study I did with over a number of years with some of my students in Santa Barbara on Walter White, who was this architect the builder who was really important in the 1940s in establishing the city of Palm Desert. Because he, I think, is actually the other side. If one wants to look at this as a juxtaposition, he was the son of a builder in San Bernardino who learned how to build houses through his father's construction business, never went to architecture school, even though he worked for a few months with Howard Hamilton Harris and for some time with Schindler. And so he picked up all this and then he went out and set himself up in the Palm Desert, La Quinta area, which is sort of neighboring territory to Palm Springs in the Coachella Valley. And that was a town which was then established, Palm Desert, by the Henderson brothers. And Walter White had this little construction business there. And so whenever the land development office was sort of selling lots in this future Palm Desert, one gets a sense of, and they said, oh, you know, down the road there is this guy who has his construction business.
Yeah.
And so he talked to him and he designed sort of significant number of the early houses. And I think this is kind of, I see them sort of as the other facet of architecture in California, where we have this construction guy who clearly wanted to be an architect. Because when you look at his designs, they have sort of certain detailing where, as an architectural historian or as an architect, one gets really excited. For example, mitered glass corners, where you have two sheets of glass coming to each other in a 90-degree angle or in a slightly different angle without any framing in the corner.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, expensive, was then expensive and is today still expensive. But it also means that in the corner you can't have any structural post or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And that sort of is a real achievement of modern architecture, where you sort of separate out the space enclosing facade from the structural system which actually holds up the building. So in a masonry building where the walls are part of the structural system, in the corner, you always have to really make sure that these two walls are very closely physically connected with each other. So the corner is a really important part of the structural system.
Yeah.
The moment you can put into a corner a mitered glass corner, so you've actually sort of show that you are sort of a modern architect.
Right, so this
mitered glass corner for Walter White becomes a real sort of symbol of his aspirations, to sell his clients a modern design for a little house. I mean, his houses are sometimes only 700-800 square feet. I mean, they're very modest, small houses, but it also sort of is the aspiration of the clients, I think.
Yeah.
I have a modern house in Palm Desert.
Yeah, yeah.
And I have this mitered glass corner. It's not a room height mitered glass corner, as maybe Neutra has done it in some of his houses. The Tremaine house in Santa Barbara has this super famous mitered glass corner in the bedroom, in the master bedroom. And then we have these small mitered glass corners in Palm Desert. And so there, I think, with the Walter White project, that's really is to the other side to the Tremaine project,
okay,
where this anonymous builder. And when I started working with my students in on Palm Desert, and we have the Walter White papers in the architecture and design collection, which is 1 million plus architectural drawings collection at the UC Santa Barbara of Southern California architectural papers and archives. And when we started working on Walter White, it was very interesting in Palm Desert. There were two or three people
uh-huh.
who actually knew about Walter White. And sort of one was an elderly architect who kind of personally knew Walter White. And then there was somebody very active in the preservation work in Palm Desert. But she was sort of through her parents very much initiated into modern architecture.
Right.
And otherwise, I mean, nobody actually knew that there was this builder slash architect, and
yeah.
an architect in inverted commas, because he never had this formal qualification until in the 1980s, eventually California granted him an architectural license.
Okay.
And so it was really interesting to, you know, do sort of then have this other side of how the built environment comes about in California,
yeah.
where you think, many people think of Palm Desert or the original Palm Desert as kind of a suburb of LA, a kind of playground of LA.
Right.
And I think what we could have, what we could show with the exhibition we mounted on Walter White at the Design and Architecture Museum at UC Santa Barbara, we could sort of, on the catalog we then published, we could actually show that there was a large number of people who try to live all year round in Palm Desert, who really settled the desert because that was really cheap, affordable housing for them.
Huh.
I mean, there was a fair number of people who also just had houses and came in at certain times of the year or for certain weekends. But that these people also, when they put up their houses, bought their lots, that they did not all do self-built, but that they had sort of aesthetic aspirations in their houses. And
yeah.
that was really interesting sort of to actually look at how did this city come about and what
yeah.
was the role of this one architect in that
uh-huh.
city. And so I kind of always look at these two projects sort of, I mean, they're kind of in a conversation with each other. Even if there is absolutely no, I mean, I don't know,
right.
Tremaine's probably never heard of Walter White. Maybe Walter White heard about these famous houses or something,
yeah.
who knows. But
yeah.
I think sort of on the larger, from a larger perspective, looking at California built environment, I think there are sort of really interesting trajectories laid out in these two projects. I mean, you could say the one is high art architecture in a very traditional understanding, sort of the Tremaine houses, whereas the other one is not really vernacular architecture because it is not this anonymous build.
Yeah.
But I think it's sort of a real interesting in-between project
yeah.
with a builder who wanted to be an architect, with clients who clearly wanted to have something distinctively modern. They end up sort of getting these houses, sometimes 800, sometimes 1200 square feet. Some of these houses were clearly designed for self-building, and in other cases, Walter White sort of built them with his own crew for you as the client.
Well, in addition to your talk this afternoon at the O'Donnell Institute, which concerns Richard Neutra and the significance of his wartime experience on his later architecture, you're here in Dallas to do some research for a current project, and I wondered if you could say anything about that.
It's very much under construction project. That basically has to do with it's a continuation of the work for Walter White, who
right.
Left Palm Desert in about 1960-1961, and he actually relocated to Colorado Springs, where he then worked for until the 1980s, when he moved back to California. But when he was in Colorado Springs, he was involved with what's called the Kissing Camels Estate, which is a private sort of land development on a very topographically very beautiful site within Colorado Springs, right
mm-hmm.
next to the Gardens of the Gods, this beautiful nature preserve or large natural park on the outskirts of Colorado Springs. And so Walter White designed in this Kissing Camels estate sort of the first series of large houses. And now we're talking about really large houses. I think, if I remember correctly, sort of like 2,000, 2,500 upwards square feet of very, very beautiful houses he designs in the 1960s. And the link which sort of between, first the link between Palm Desert and Colorado Springs, that in the early days of Palm Desert, there were the Henderson brothers, who were sort of a private, from a private family, who did buy up the land and invested, but they had certain other investors, and one of them was Al Hill, and he came from the Dallas Hill family, or the oil family, and so the Al Hill had invested money into Palm Desert, but very early on took the investment out of Palm Desert, and then relocated this money, or invested this money in the Kissing Camels estate, or in the land, which then became eventually the Kissing Camels estate in Colorado Springs. And so that's the connection between Palm Desert, Colorado Springs, and then obviously Dallas. Because I'm still sort of at this stage trying to work out sort of how did actually Walter White get to Colorado Springs? I mean, what was the motivation to have him? That he came to Colorado Springs with a friend who was a construction company owner. So there was a construction company owner, there was a designer, architect. And then the other question, sort of, which really interests me, is sort of what was the motivation for the Hills, or for that part of the Hill family, into this Kissing Camels estate, which was privately held land. And is still today, in certain ways, a private estate. I mean, where you sort of like my understanding is, and I may get this wrong now in strictly legal terms, so almost to be imagined sort of as a private homeowners association. And the question really is sort of what was the motivation? Because what I figured out the story about is that initially the Hills had some property up there, built a house, and then there were certain friends who sort of could get property or lots in this land. And I think it's very interesting, but what fascinates me is about if you go to the Kissing Camels estate and you look at these early houses. You once gave a presentation in Colorado Springs at the Pikes Peak Library. They have a regional history symposium ever so often. And I gave a presentation about Walter White doing work in Colorado Springs, and I called it California under the Kissing Camels, because he really sort of takes typical California floor plans and housing types and relocates them into Colorado Springs, which then has very interesting consequences because the climate and is obviously slightly different between Colorado Springs and California desert. And so we have these mitered glass corners suddenly popping up in Colorado Springs, and which obviously generates interesting sort of technical issues, how to keep them tight against rain and snow and so on. But it is quite interesting because this image emerges sort of this Kissing Camels estate, sort of almost like a retreat from the heat in the desert. So you have a house in the desert. If it gets too hot there, then you can sort of relocate into the Kissing Camels estate. So there is this geography, one could almost describe this sort of where people of a certain wealth have houses and how they actually live in this house throughout, let's say, a calendar year. And that sort of, I think, is really interesting because if you look at these houses on the Kissing Camels estate, the early ones, I mean, they're so large in terms of closet space and in terms of how you actually live there. And I think it's very interesting to sort of maybe hopefully be able to figure out a little more, to get some more information on the interest the Hill family may have had in this estate and what the actual history is.
Yeah.
But this is very much at the beginning.
Right.
And so hopefully at some point there will be some essay or something coming out of this.
Well, this is the Athenaeum Review podcast, and our guest today is Volker M. Belter. Thank you very much for coming.
My pleasure.
The Athenaeum Review podcast is produced by Creative Disturbance. Find out more at creativedisturbance.org.